This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, it's Emma Barnett here. Welcome to the Woman's Hour podcast. On today's programme, we will look at President Trump's historic second impeachment through the eyes of one of the key Republican women driving the charge. We'll also be joined by the UK's new equality and human rights champion and find out what she's going to do for you and for all of us. Baroness Kishra Faulkner will be joining us. Her job is the new chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which is this country's equality and discrimination watchdog. And we'll meet the woman trying to name some of the thousands of people, migrants and refugees, who've lost their lives in the Mediterranean in the last 15 years. Professor Cristina Cataneo will be joining us to explain her mission. But what I want to ask you today, and what I want you to text in on, email in on, get in touch on social media on, it's something quite personal. Your crushes, adult crushes to be precise, but you can talk about the younger ones as well. The unlikelier the better. We're looking into the psychology of them today and if they're good for you. If you tell us yours, you don't have to give your real name, I should say, but perhaps it has helped at a time of difficulty. Perhaps you've even had a crush during lockdown and it's given you an extra spring in your step. No names needed, I'll stress that. Are crushes, adult ones in particular, are they healthy or are they dangerous? Are they infidelity of the mind? We'll be getting into all of that, but I need your help. What are yours? I was thinking of mine, especially from when I was a bit younger. The lead singer of Blur, Damon Albarn, just was convinced if I could get in front of him, I could convince him we could be together. And in fact, I once did go up to him in the street and we're not together. So let's just leave that at that. But tell us about yours. 84844, that's the number you need to text in on. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. Or social media. It's BBC Woman's Hour, or email us through our website. I'm looking forward to hearing what you have to say on that. And of course, anything else you hear in the programme, do get in touch, as you are doing and have been doing. Now, yesterday, the eyes of America were mainly on one woman. For a period of time, certainly, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, one of 10 Republicans who crossed the floor and voted with the Democrats to impeach President Trump for the second time, something that's never happened before to a president. A key trigger in all of this was, of course, the storming of the Capitol building last week. Here is Liz Cheney talking to Fox News from inside the Capitol building, criticising President Trump's role in stoking that attack.
We just had a violent mob assault the U.S. Capitol in an attempt to prevent us from carrying out our constitutional duty. And there's no question that the president formed the mob, the president incited the mob, the president addressed the mob, he lit the flame. This is what America is not. There's just been, it's absolutely intolerable and unacceptable. And the mob will not prevail. You know, we all have taken an oath to the Constitution. It's an oath that we carry out. It doesn't bend, to mob rule. It doesn't bend to political threats. It's an oath under God, and we will carry it out. And what happened today can never happen again in the United States, and the president needs to take responsibility for it.
Well, in this sense, she kept to her word and crossed the floor and voted with Democrats to impeach. But who is Liz Cheney? And is she the political hero some are saying she is? Is she trying to save the Republicans from doom and destruction at its most desperate hour? I spoke just before coming on air to Amy Pope, former Deputy Home Security Advisor to President Obama.
So Liz Cheney is the daughter of the former U.S. Vice President George Bush, Dick Cheney, who was very well known, particularly in the response to 9/11. She is the member of Congress for the state of Wyoming, conservative, very traditional conservative member of Congress. And, you know, she serves in Republican leadership. So not necessarily stand out for any sort of fiery brand of politics here, just a good Republican, frankly.
A good, solid Republican who is now one of the lead figures in trying to impeach Donald Trump.
She has taken a stand here, along with a handful of other Republicans in the House, to make clear that what happened last week was a bridge too far in terms of the president's actions. And, you know, there are some who will see her as a hero for doing so, because she's certainly standing up against the tide of very, very vocal Republicans, but others who will see her as just echoing the sentiment of many other Republicans who felt like this is just a different situation.
There are some already saying, don't call Liz Cheney a hero here, because you've got to look at the reality here, the impact perhaps of large donors withdrawing their support for Republican lawmakers. Why hasn't she done this sooner? Why haven't her and her colleagues taken this stance sooner?
Yes, I mean, that's going to be the question for the Republican Party for years to come. This is not the first time that the president has really pushed the boundaries when it comes to American norms or even the law, really. And certainly there were calls just a year ago for people like Liz Cheney to stand up, and she didn't. So there's very mixed views on how she should be perceived, but there are others who will say when she needed to take a stand, and this one is probably the most egregious example anyone could have imagined, she did.
She voted against gay marriage. She's against abortion. Is she held up as an ideal or as an icon to certain parts of American society, or how should we view her as a woman?
As a woman, she is, I think her first identity is with the Republican Party and the conservative values. And frankly, we need women representing all parts of the policy debate. And she is certainly demonstrating that she's not being defined just by her gender, that she has her own beliefs and her own values, and she votes for them. So she does not vote for what we would see as traditional women's issues. But at the same time, she's a woman in a leadership position, and she is well respected for that.
She's also now, as you say, a handful, there's only 10 of them, two of them are women who crossed the floor, as it were, voted to impeach Donald Trump for a second time. She's going to face, and is already facing, stiff opposition within her own party. People who do not think this is the right time, even if they might think it's the right thing to do, but this is the right time to do this. And she'll have to stand up to those forces, won't she?
She will. And it's not clear how that balance will tip. At this moment, the Republican Party is very divided. We're seeing on the Senate side, the Senate Majority Leader, who's a Republican, Mitch McConnell, effectively leak to the press that he's considering moving forward the impeachment in one breath, and then suggesting he won't do so anytime soon in another breath. So there's that suggests that the Republican Party is really weighing where it's going to come down on this. And you know, it's not necessarily going to come down to just a matter of principle. They're going to be looking at where are their voters and how is this going to impact their elections. And someone taking a stand against Donald Trump is taking a risk.
Do you feel grateful to her? I mean, of course, you're on the other side of the political divide, but when you're thinking about this moment in your country's history?
I do, not because of her whole record here, but I believe that members of Congress, they do take an oath to defend and uphold the Constitution. And I believe they need to take that responsibility very seriously. The founders of the Republic decided that the Congress should be a check on the power of the president. And they're meant to be an independent authority. They're meant to exercise that authority separate from where the president is. And we're not seeing a lot of that in the Republican Party over the last couple of years. They've really been captured by Donald Trump and his base. So,
well, they were, you know, 70 million also continue to vote for Donald Trump in the last election. We shouldn't forget that President Trump doesn't want to let anybody forget that, of course. But it is an important point to reflect the American public as well, not just the Republican Party. How struck are you, to bring this together, because we'll have to see how this plays out, but how struck are you that it is Liz Cheney and Nancy Pelosi, two women really, who are making the headlines at the moment with this whole process?
I'm struck only that it hasn't happened sooner. You know, that there are several women in Congress and government who just get things done and who are sensible and I think can see issues from multiple sides of the debate. I don't necessarily think that's gendered, but it has been remarkable that there hasn't been room for more women to play that role. And so I think it's a good thing to have women from both parties in the forefront of these conversations. You know, and bottom line, it was scary. I mean, there were members of Congress huddling on the floor of the chamber, afraid for their lives. And there's something to be said for recognizing that situation as being absolutely untenable and one that shouldn't be repeated by a president of the United States.
Amy Pope, their former deputy home security advisor to President Obama. Now, there is a new champion of equalities and human rights in the UK. Her job is to make sure nobody will be discriminated on the basis of their gender, race, age, religion, body or otherwise. And if you have been, she and her organisation are meant to be able to help. Her name? Well, because you should know it, Baroness Kisha Faulkner, a former Lib Dem peer, used to speak for the party on foreign affairs and other things. She now sits as an independent peer in the House of Lords, and her new job is chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, this country's equality and discrimination watchdog. The EHRC, as it's referred to in shorthand, most recent and high-profile investigations that you may recall have been into equal pay here at the BBC, anti-Semitism within the Labour Party, to name another. Its Twitter tagline says, "It's here to stand up for freedom, compassion and justice in our changing times." But it's safe to say it has its critics too. Baroness Kisha Faulkner, good morning.
Good morning.
Why you? How did you land this job? What qualifies you for the role?
Well, I think you have to ask my employers what qualifies me for the role. I applied for the job through public appointments. That's the system for all recruitments to quasi-government jobs, non-departmental public bodies, as they're called. And I went through, I would say, an incredibly rigorous process. It took about 4 or 5 months, I think it was. And here I am.
The reason I ask is because there was a concern in as part of that rigorous process, and I was reading part of it last night. It's all publicly available. There was concern by the Women and Equalities Commission when approving you to the role at the end of last year that you were overly focused on the managerial and administrative side of things. And actually, they need a champion. They need somebody to set this a light. What have you got that's making your fire burn on this?
Well, it's very interesting. They asked me that question. I thought it was a curious question. One of the things you haven't told your listeners is that we're also a regulator. And a regulator has compliance enforcement powers. It's a litigator as well. It has statutory, in other words, legal duties that it has to carry out. And I think anyone who's been anywhere near the law at all will tell you that process is 9/10 of success in law. So if you're being criticized by politicians because you're process-driven and managerial in an organization which has had a rocky birth and 13-year past, I take that as a very positive sign of having the right credentials.
And well, they obviously took it the same way because they gave you the job and they're going to see how you do, as we all are. I mean, it is one of those jobs, though. Where do you start? Of course, now with the COVID pandemic, severe inequalities exposed even more in our country, disproportionate effect on you know, Black and Asian minority ethnic communities, the health service, the economy. Where do you see as your top priority at the moment?
I think I have three priorities. One is to ensure that our equality laws don't get dumbed down through practice by employers as we move into a very difficult economic framework going ahead. The other one is to ensure that certain categories of people, we call them protected characteristics, they're the people whose rights we really have to defend above and beyond others. And we have to ensure that those categories of people don't get disadvantaged. I mean, you're called Woman's Hour. It's women who are more likely to get disadvantaged through this in the early analysis that we've done than other people. So ethnic minorities, potentially, as well. Most people in low-paying jobs, including men. So we're already taking actions. We've warned employers about the things they need to bear in mind if they're looking at redundancies, for example. We've been working with a health service on protecting and getting more data on minority communities, disabled people with existing conditions. So COVID has kind of exposed a lot of things that are not necessarily illegal practice, but potentially give us warning signs of where there is still inequality and potentially discrimination in society. That's what it's done. Shone a light.
And let's come back to the effectiveness and your ability to be effective at the EHRC. And it is right to point out it is a regulator. But I've just noticed a message, for instance, that's just come in from one of our listeners saying, I'm wondering why she got the job. We can't trust anyone appointed by this government anymore. They're all incompetent and corrupt. That seems to be to do with views of who's got certain contracts for PPE, for instance, at this moment. And trust levels are waning in this government because of what's going on with the pandemic and other issues. The Minister for Women and Equalities, Liz Truss, signed off on your appointment. You are independent of the government. What do you make of her record on equalities?
If I recall, she hasn't been the Secretary of State for Employment for that long. So it's very difficult to judge somebody's record in just over a year. I tend to make my decisions on a considered basis over a longer period of time. Where I see her going and the direction of travel that she articulates seems to me interesting in the sense that she's, again, I'm afraid to say, looking at processes. So she's looking at better use across government of data and to aggregate the data, set up an equalities hub within the Cabinet Office. The Cabinet Office itself, the move of EHRC into one government department that has oversight of the whole of government, to me is a very positive step. Your listeners may not know, but previously we used to follow whichever minister was made the relevant Minister for Women and Equalities in cabinet. We used to go with them to different departments. So if you have the Secretary of State for International Development, who was the relevant minister, we were suddenly sitting in DFID. Sitting in the Department for Education.
It's fair enough to say you don't want to judge just yet, but you're looking at data, and she's going to look at data, and you're having a look as well as that. But she gave a speech at the end of last year talking about how she wants to do equality and how she wants to change it. She talked about, you know, the left being enthralled to ideas that undermine equality at every turn. But this is a government that's been in power for a decade. So you must have a view on how equality has gone there. And if you're talking about data, at her own department, this is the Department of International Trade, the gender pay gap in her own department has increased more than 3 percentage points. In the year to March 2020. I could also talk to you about the skew towards men as a greater proportion of her senior staff. So her own record on equality is fully available. What do you make of that as our new equalities chief?
I don't think I really want to be drawn on what I make of a Secretary of State, because that takes me into the political sphere. As a regulator, we've got to be not just be impartial, but we've got to be seen to be impartial. We're independent of government, and that is the one thing I would emphasise.
Yes, but you've got to surely have a view on the person who's presiding over equality. Okay, let me bring it closer to you.
I may have a view. I don't think I'm going to share it with the listeners of Woman's Hour.
Well, that's a shame.
My views. One of the things you do as a regulator and as a public servant is that you quite often have to keep your views to yourself.
All right.
Act on the evidence.
Let me share something that's much closer to what your new job is then. She has approved some of your board commissioners, the EHRC board commissioners. And I presume you do have a view here. For instance, Jessica Butcher, who some have been concerned by, looking at one of her TEDx talk in 2018, she says, modern feminism disempowers women. She said that it's obsessed with female victimhood. I could also go on to talk about how she believes you should handle discrimination. She said on her appointment, she's an old school feminist and wants to work to advance equality issues here in the UK. But do you agree with her that modern feminism disempowers women?
No, I don't agree that modern feminism disadvantages women. But on the other hand, I haven't discussed any of this with her. She was appointed before my time. I have interacted with her for the last 5 weeks that I've been in post. And we have a good working relationship, as we do with, as I have with all the 13 other commissioners that they are. Let me say one thing about people's views, which I think is terribly important. We're in living in times where you have culture wars, what are described as culture wars, what are described, sometimes described as cancel culture, where people, there is no civility in public discourse any longer. And I think that we've come to a stage where I want people, if I were appealing for civility in public life, to have more moderately expressed views and to speak to each other more respectfully. But having said all of that, I think diversity of thinking is critical to solving problems together.
So
we
so
don't
you sound...
solve problems together when we groupthink. And Emma, can I take you to another role that I do? I work with financial services. I'm a regulator for the Bank of England. I think when you saw the analysis that was done after the financial crash as to the representation of women on boards of some of our biggest financial services companies and banks, you found a clear problem with the diversity of thought. Diversity of thought and diversity of representation.
So you sound
terribly important.
And you sound very, you know, convinced of that in her appointment, for instance, and we look forward to welcoming her to Woman's Hour. But it was safe to say people were concerned, hence the question to you. A big part of this is around what power you actually have in terms of being a regulator. Your budget, EHRC, has gone from 70 million at its inception down to 17 million. And of course, just to look at one of the investigations recently, you looked into pay here at the BBC. You said the BBC wasn't really in the wrong when it came to how it paid staff who were men compared to women, but they could do better. Some called it a whitewash and criticised the methodology. How can you hold the BBC's feet to the fire when there isn't something unlawful? How will you do that?
Well, we've made a series of recommendations. Even this week, we met with the Director General and other senior staff. We have another meeting with them. We have periodic meetings now in the Director General's calendar. They have committed to producing an action plan for us. And that's going to cover all of our recommendations. And frankly, the feedback I get from my colleagues who are working on this is that we're very pleased with the progress that's being made at the BBC, but we will continue to see. Action plans comprise deadlines where they have to comply with some of the things we've asked for, and evidence-based. They've got to show us the figures. That's how you hold an organisation where you haven't found unlawful action, but you're wishing to work with them to make sure that they get better at what they're doing.
Well, I look forward to talking to you again to go forward with some of the things that you've talked about and to follow up. Thank you for your time this morning. Baroness Kisha Faulkner there, who's now in post as the chair of the EHRC. So many of you are getting in touch about our next discussion with regard to crushes. We're exploring the psychology of adult crushes. So we thought we had to turn to the one and only Barry White for a moment.
Tell me, what can I say? What am I gonna do? How should I feel when everything is you? What kind of love is this?
Let me just give you a flavour of what's coming in here. Bob Hoskins was and is my forever crush. I've no idea why, as I'm 5'11", so physically wouldn't have been a great match. This one, for years I had a photo of Russell Crowe on my wall, the man whose velvet wolf voice made my knees weaken. The photo came with us through several house moves, and during menopause I became aware that if I looked at my pin-up, I would ovulate almost immediately and have yet another period. I felt it absolutely clearly many times and was amused to think that this hot crush may have been contributing to my long drawn out change. My cousin had an even bigger photo above her marital bed. Wow. And Pam says, Emma, how can an adult crush be an infidelity of the mind when fantasising, presumably about someone other than your partner, is an acceptable as part of a healthy sex life? Well, let's get into this. As we age, crushes still occur. You may still remember your teenage ones, but they do tend to be a guilty secret. Are there benefits, though, to having crushes? Facebook introduced a secret crush feature in December last year, and it's claimed that it can induce mood-boosting chemicals. Should we see crushes as normal, exciting and harmless ways of understanding ourselves and our need, and perhaps helping us through tough times like lockdown? Or is it morally questionable if you're in a loving, committed relationship? Deborah Waters won the Bridport Prize last year for her short story, Oh Hululu, about an adult crush. And Helen Thompson is a science journalist and author whose new book is called This Book Could Fix Your Life, in which she shares her advice on affairs of the heart. Helen, let me start with you. What exactly is a crush?
Yeah, so generally we think of a crush as an intense but brief period of high emotion and infatuation or obsession towards another person, often but not always in the context of those feelings being unrequited or that person being unattainable in some manner. But from a neuroscience perspective, it's a little different. It's actually thought of as an uncontrollable drive that evolved millions of years ago as a survival mechanism to help us bond with other people.
And are they good for us? Should we see them as healthy? Because, you know, people discuss, don't they, walking a little taller, doing their hair a bit nicer, all those sorts of things. They can improve your mood.
Yeah, well, when we form a crush, we see these ancient areas of the brain kick in. We experience these great jolts of dopamine, the feel-good reward chemicals that give us that feeling of intense pleasure. And so, of course, it feels good to have a crush. You then take those feelings and how that develops and what comes of that is probably where you then stray into a territory of whether it's good or bad.
We'll talk to bring Deborah in at this point. Deborah, you won the Bridport short story competition last year, we were saying, with Oh Hululu, a highly fictionalized story about your experiences of an adult crush. And was it a secret from those around you?
Well, yes, because I think fundamentally crushes belong in the realm of fantasy. And I knew, being an adult and having some control over my emotions, that it was just a form of escapism for me. And I didn't really want to share it. It was like my sort of personal little private joy. And it was also a little bit embarrassing. You don't, as a grown woman and a mother, you don't want to admit to crushes that make you sound like you're 12 years old.
We'll come back to that thought in a moment. Let's hear a short excerpt of the story now.
You meet him in October. You're wearing jeans, a red jumper, flat boots. It's the last time you dress down. You like his tree-like height and his hair. Is it auburn? Blonde? You're not sure why, but this charms you. When you realise you're at least a decade older than him, you head to the toilet and reapply your makeup. At the bar, you down Sauvignon Blanc until the booze takes over your tongue. When his answers turn circumspect, equivocal, you feel like a nosy aunt. You may as well ask him what he wants to be when he grows up, but he doesn't move seats. You like your life, your terrace with its fitful plumbing, your white dog and medium-sized family car. You're comfortably numb, think this is a good thing. As days pass, your mind, normally crammed with school books and whitewashes and grocery dashes, fills with him. It's your imagination, but it's palpable. When you cook, he's a hologram leaning against the fridge, describing his day. You reply hilariously, of course. When you shower, he's pressed against your back, his hand cupping the baby-made curve of your stomach.
Gosh, that's taken me right into that. What a powerful piece of writing.
Thank you.
Your husband's not read it, is that right?
Yes, but that was my choice. Because it's highly fictionalized, it's very embellished, and I didn't want him to not be able to separate fact from fiction. But, you know, I'm very happily married. I've got a great relationship with my husband. Though, you know, I'm a writer and I write about the things that make me feel. And I also realize it wasn't something that's written about much. But it is embellished to sort of give it more sort of gravitas.
Because it comes from a small seed when you were on a creative writing course,
yes,
is that right? Something
absolutely.
You felt a little of. Because some people getting in touch to say they feel guilty if they were to say anything about it, like it is unfaithful in some way.
Yeah, I can see why people think that, but there's a huge difference between a crush and an affair. Like Helen was saying, that it's usually directed at someone who's unsuitable or unobtainable. If they were obtainable, you'd be going down the realms of something more physical or like an actual relationship. But that was never my intention with any of the crushes I've ever had. That's not what I've wanted. I'm very happy with what I've got. It's more a form of escape. And also, crushes can help you work things out in your head about your own relationship. You can have a little dialogue with this sort of person, and it's actually been beneficial to my marriage.
I've just got a few messages in that I thought you'd like to hear, both of you. I recall a post on a toddler website where a mum admitted to having a crush on Mr. Tumble. So we'll just put that one out there. Claire says, Julia Bradbury, my wife knows and understands. And another one here from Emma who says, I've got a major crush on BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner. I love his clipped vowels and his voice brightens the day when he's on the Today programme. So there you go. A few people being actually named here. But it is, for a lot of people, something they probably wouldn't text in about and don't feel they can. Helen, in terms of what you should perhaps take from this, is it that maybe you haven't got everything you needed from the relationship you're in and the crush satisfies another part of you or a different part of you you haven't really explored?
I think that's a hard question to answer. I think it was interesting that Deborah said that it was something she was a bit embarrassed about having, that it was something that a 15-year-old, you know, would have. But actually, what happens in the brain when you have a crush is something that you can experience at any age. And it's actually, like I said, this uncontrollable drive that comes from a part of the brain that is evolutionarily ancient. And, you know, it's when you compare the brains of someone who are having a crush or are in the first throes of lust in a new relationship, we see this a lot of similarities between their brain and people who have drug addictions or have OCD. And it's really interesting. We see this in activity where we have this part of the brain that's creating this euphoria and these cravings and this need to get a hit, like a drug addict would need to get a hit, but we're getting that hit from this person, this seeing this person or getting a text from them. And at the same time, we see a drop in serotonin in the brain, which is a chemical that helps us regulate our mood. It kind of gives us our rationality. It regulates our appetites. It helps us sleep. It controls our anxiety and our sexual desires. And it's kind of like we see the brain, the rational part of the brain, actually lift its brake upon these more basic drives. And so it's kind of no wonder that we act so strangely and erratically and we feel guilty when we have a crush on someone. But in fact, it's actually perhaps not something that we can control and we shouldn't be embarrassed about.
And perhaps talk about, which we're trying to do here on Mum's Hour, and getting quite a response. Deborah, just finally to you, do you think it should stay taboo, or do you think we should talk about it more? Is it one of those things that should stay private?
And I just think it depends on the individual and it depends what needs aren't being met. And I think there is a misconception that if you have a crush on someone, it's some sort of sexual emotional needs that aren't met. Whereas for me, it was very much to do with the fact that I was middle-aged. I was having a bit of a midlife crisis. I was drawn to things I missed, like people that were younger than me. I missed their freedom and their youth. And so it's a lot more complex than just fancying somebody.
And you could see where that came from. Deborah, thank you very much for talking to us today. Deborah Waters there and Helen Thompson with their takes on crushes. Keep those messages coming in. I'll return to them if I can. Now, an estimated 30,000 migrants and refugees have lost their lives in the Mediterranean in the last 15 years. Take that in. 30,000 human beings that we don't know the names or stories of. One woman is spearheading work to try and name as many as possible to give these people some dignity and respect in death and, crucially, to allow their families to know what happened to them. Cristina Cattaneo, Professor of Forensic Medicine at the University of Milan, has spent the last 5 years voluntarily running a project with others to identify just some of those who have lost their lives. She joins me now. Cristina, welcome.
Hi, hello.
Why have you spent the last 5 years of your life trying to identify the bodies from these terrible losses?
Well, I'm a forensic pathologist, and one of the main commandments is that when you have a disaster and you have dead people to identify, that's what you do, because it belongs to the rights of those who are still looking for them. So it's just a must, regardless of who these people are.
And how did you begin this work? Can you take us into it a bit?
Yes. Most forensic pathologists deal with, well, as you may imagine, autopsies and identification of bodies, and therefore it's something that's in our DNA. But my lab in particular in Milan has dealt with research in identification for 25 years. And the more we got into it, the more we realized that even on a domestic basis, a lot of people end up in graves without an identity. And this led us to collaborate with a big office of government in Italy, which deals with missing persons and unidentified bodies. And then finally, when the migration emergency, quote unquote, took place, we started asking ourselves, well, if we always rush and run to identify, you know, victims of air crashes, why are we doing nothing for these people? So we started a pilot project on two main disasters, two of the largest disasters that we know, whose victims ended up on the Italian shores, just to prove that these people have to be identified and that they can be identified, because the leitmotif is that, well, you know, nobody's looking for them because they may come from sub-Saharan Africa, but that's not true, as we've discovered in working on it.
How do you go and identify the bodies? Could you tell us a bit more about that? Because yeah. I know it's your line of work, but to many, you know, that they won't have heard this, and it's obviously incredibly upsetting work to people to hear about.
Yes, of course. I mean, I have to just sort of like stress the fact that, you know, identifying the bodies is obligatory. It's compulsory, not just for administrative and civil purposes, but imagine being the mother of, you know, your son, and you don't know whether he's alive or dead. So it becomes a question of mental health of the loved ones who are looking for that missing person. So that said, how do you identify dead bodies? Well, usually it's quite simple. You have to imagine having an air crash, and you have to collect the data that is useful for identifying bodies, which goes from the tattoos on your neck to DNA, and you have to compare that data with data coming from the relatives of these people, who usually give you what we call antemortem information. In other words, information on the same kind of things, like the tattoos and the DNA profile, coming from the family. So what you have to do is compare the information from the body to the information on the missing persons. And once you have these two sets of data, it's quite simple. The problem is that with the migration crisis, we are in front of a huge, as you said before, at least 30,000, but this is the tip of the iceberg. Individuals who have died, so it's a major mass disaster with at least 30,000 victims. But imagine this: the victims being diluted in time, because it's over the years, and in places. Some are on the shores of Sicily, some in other parts of Italy, some in Greece, some in Malta. And therefore, the difficulty is collecting the data on the dead, first of all, in a, you know, homogeneous manner, and then getting in touch with the relatives who may be in countries of origin, who may not even know that someone was trying to identify these people. So it becomes more complicated from a logistic point of view rather than from a scientific point.
Just in terms of the actual shipwrecks as well of this, because it's important to describe, there was a large loss of life in October 2013 when a boat went down off the Italian island of Lampedusa, killing 366 migrants on board, and a second tragedy with an even larger loss of life in April 2015 when a boat sank carrying 1,000 refugees and migrants travelling from Libya on their way to Italy. Now, that boat was raised, as I understand it, in June 2016. That must have been an incredibly traumatizing experience for all of you involved, as well as, of course, having to get on and do the job. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I remember that our prime minister decided to pull the boat out, because he said, you know, we need to just show Europe and show the world what is going on. And I think this boat has a very important story to tell, because these victims tell a story that, you know, the survivors don't tell, because they represent the tragedy and the risk verifying itself. So basically, when the boat was pulled out of it, it had sunk at 400 meters with at least 1,000 passengers on it. The fire brigade started, you know, pulling the bodies outside the boat, and virtually what we saw was the condition in which these individuals die and travel. And therefore, we were confronted with layers of dead bodies. Only in the bilge, we had 500 individuals. And these represented young adults, mainly males through this disaster, and adolescents. And the adolescents were traveling. We found the skeletons of these 14, 15, 16-year-olds underneath the boards of the bilge, and which meant that already they were traveling, lying down beneath the floorboards, and I think this tells a very eloquent story. And basically, we calculated that there were 5 people per square meter. And again, in doing the autopsies, in performing the autopsies, you actually realize who these people were, because when we do autopsies, and we did the autopsies on all these bodies, you roam through their pockets and through their personal belongings, looking for things that will help you identify them or try and figure out how to identify in which countries to go looking for their loved ones and their relatives. And what we found was, you know, what we would find in our pockets. So wallets, pictures, love letters, letters coming from relatives who were writing to them to not cross the Mediterranean, to look for work in the south of Africa, mementos, small pouches of soil from their homeland. And I think this brings everything very much close to home. And it's very, very eloquent, more than what anything I can say.
And is that what drives you, that need to recognise that humanity?
Yes, of course. I mean, what drives you is a mixture between something professional, because as a forensic pathologist, you're raised to identify. It's the first thing you do on a body. But also, I was personally, and my colleagues, we have been struck by the fact that this is a double tragedy for these people, because first of all, you die, you know, in the middle of the Mediterranean, and then nobody even thinks of identifying you, which we would do normally for anyone. And therefore, this sort of like touches you from a human point of view, and you just can't stay and look and do nothing.
And I know that you want a proper network and of information and hotspots for this to be recorded, and crucially for the family members to be alerted to find out what actually happened.
That's the solution. That's the easy solution. I think from a European perspective, it would be sufficient that every country has a hotspot and uses the offices, like the police officers or whichever offices are delegated to do identification work on normal cases. And if every country had a hotspot where to put, you know, the data on the dead bodies and collect data from relatives. So if you're living in France, Germany, wherever, you would know where to go to look for your loved one. Whereas now these people, the loved ones, the mothers and fathers and sons and daughters looking for their dead, don't know where to go and end up having no answer, which we know yes. brings to mental illness. Yeah.
Professor Christina Cataneo, thank you very much for your time. And we should also say, in Crossing Continents today at 11 o'clock after the news, you can hear more detail about that Mediterranean shipwreck in April 2015, where 1,000 migrants and refugees died, and Professor Cataneo's attempts to identify them. Thank you to her. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Candace Lim.
And I'm Rachel Hampton. We're the hosts of ICYMI, Slate's podcast about internet culture.
And we want to help you make sense of the need-to-know internet stories of the week.
Consider us your internet historians of past, present, and future.
Of the good, the bad, and the truly unhinged.
From nuanced takes on stories we're all closely following, to the ones you wished you heard about.
In case you missed it, that's ICYMI, the podcast that's extremely online, so you don't have to be. Follow and listen now.